American Forum of the Air with Theodore Granick, its founder and moderator. Brought to you by Universal Carloading and Distributing Company, America's leading nationwide forwarder of less-than-carload fast freight. Now, friends, the year now ending has brought many problems, but let's not forget it's brought many benefits, too. For example, in the field of transportation, genuine progress has been made in bridging the gap between sender and receiver of less-than-carload fast freight. Today, more than ever, the modern forwarder takes full charge of such shipments, picks them up, routes them by rail, truck, or water, delivers them right to customer's door. This complete one-responsibility service results in real economies to sender, receiver, and public alike. So if you regularly ship or receive less-than-carload fast freight, learn how Universal Carloading, America's pioneer nationwide freight forwarder, can help you. Yes, discover why it pays for shipments, commercial, to specify Universal. And now, Mr. Granick.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. What's ahead for business in 1949? Here to tell us are two distinguished authorities, Leon H. Keiseling, Vice Chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, and Merrill Stanley Rukeyser, nationally syndicated economic columnist for International News Service and editorial writer for the Hearst newspapers. Now let's start the discussion with the New Year firecracker. Which will it be, Mr. Keiseling, boom or bust in 49?
I don't think, Mr. Granick, that we ought to have a boom or a bust in 1949 or in any other year. A boom is a balloon being blown to the point where it breaks. We don't want the balloon of our economy to break. We want it to stay up in the air. And therefore, we should adopt policies to check the boom so that it will not turn into a bust. And I'm fully confident that we can do that.
How about those policies, Mr. Rukeyser?
Well, I think we can have pretty good business next year if the politicians don't intervene with too many of those policies. I agree with Mr. Keiseling that there's are other possibilities besides boom and bust. We're already in the midst of a readjustment in special items, especially in the soft good lines. And if we continue these readjustments and put the house of industry by industry in order, we're building on a sounder foundation for the future. I don't want to see any interference with a healthy readjustment.
Mr. Keiseling.
Well, I'm interested in the new philosophy of the relationship between business and government that Mr. Rukeyser states. I always thought that it was conventional philosophy, and I'm a conventionalist, that business was primarily responsible for the condition of business and should remain so. Now, I think we ought to have a constructive program, and I think business and government ought to work together. And you can't work together by beginning to tell the other fellow what not to do. I'd like to ask Mr. Rukeyser two questions. First, specifically, what affirmatively should business do to change the boom into a stable prosperity? And second, what specifically should government do to change the boom into a stable prosperity?
That's a big order. Go ahead, Mr. Rukeyser.
I don't want to get mixed up in a politician's frame of reference. I want to talk in simple words about very simple matters. Mr. Keiseling knows, and I know, that the production of goods and services is done by individuals and aggregates of individuals and not by government. Government constitutes social overhead and dips into the kitty and takes something out of each man's income in order to pay for that overhead. Now, all I want of government next year is that they shouldn't, in a period of readjustment in the fourth year after the war, when enterprises are sensitive and watching the indicators closely, they shouldn't needlessly muddy the waters by trying to redeem campaign promises that are mutually inconsistent and that don't hang together. That's all I mean.
Well, it's perfectly obvious that Mr. Rukeyser has come here with the firm attempt to make a political speech and to muddy the waters. My questions were very simple. I asked him, as a spokesman for business, if not a businessman, to say what specifically he thought business could do to help get over the boom. And I asked him to state what he thought government could do to help get over the boom. His answer is that I should not make political speeches and that government should not muddy the waters.
Well, I'll start with the second question first. If Mr. Kaiserling's clients and people whom he speaks for don't want what they roughly call inflation, then I'll ask them not to come out next week with a budget of upwards of $45 billion.
Which client do you mean, the president?
Yeah, the president of the United States. If
That's
they
a good
don't,
client.
If the if his client doesn't want high prices for goods and services, then I'll ask him not to add to the cost of production by excessive social overhead and by increased taxes. If he doesn't like the high cost of living, then I'll ask him to modify his commitments to farmers in the way of peak income and to workers in the way of higher hourly wage rates. You have to make a choice. You have to have either inflation or deflation. You can't run in two opposite directions at the same time, even if you have a council of economic advisors to help you.
How about that client of yours, Mr. Kaiserling?
Well, I'm extremely anxious not to run in two directions at one time. And let's apply that to this question of spending and taxes. Now I can go along with Mr. Rukeyser when he says that more spending contributes to inflation because it puts more money into the economy. But he also seems to say that lower taxes fight inflation. He doesn't say that more spending contributes to inflation because it puts money into the economy, but more taxation fights inflation because it takes money out of the economy. Now, I'd like to be consistent on that. I'd like to say that in an inflationary period, we should spend as little as we possibly can, consistent with our national needs.
How much?
I don't think that we can get much below a budget of $45 billion, and I challenge anyone who says that we can to state specifically whether he would cut payments to veterans, whether he would stop payments on the national debt, whether he would lower interest payments on the debt, whether he would have lower expenditures for foreign aid, whether he would have lower expenditures for national defense.
But going on
to the second point, I would say that we should spend as little as we can consistently with our welfare, and that we should raise taxes to draw some money out of the economy.
Mr. Kaiser.
Well, and answering one question at a time, if I may.
Go ahead, sir.
The gentleman asks whether I would reduce expenses by repudiating contracts such as the interest contract. I want to make it clear at the outset that I'm not a New Dealer and don't believe in repudiating contracts. I believe there are other ways of economizing in government. I believe that if we could get along in 1939 with 900,000 civilian employees of the federal government, that we don't necessarily need about 2,000,001 at the present time. But specifically, rather than allow the bureaucrats with their vested interest to fight for every pencil that they say they need, I would recommend to the committees of the Congress that when the presidential budget is submitted next week, that they set a ceiling for the budget and then return the budget to the Budget Bureau with instructions to bring back an alternate budget within the maximum that the Congress sets. Congress is supposed, under the Constitution, to control the purse strings, and that's the procedure that I'd recommend, Mr. Moderator.
Well, I still think that you haven't answered the question at all, because the question has been a very simple one. Specifically, what expenditures would you cut?
Well,
that's
I mentioned when I cut the employees from 2,000,001 to something nearer the pre-war level.
No, that avoids the question. Employees execute programs. You can't cut the employees who are supervising the collection of taxes unless you want to have less lax tax enforcement.
I'd send
you want
home
to cut
some
the
of the
numbers?
Advisors,
please.
Do you want? I think I better continue talking to avoid insults, because that's the only way I can avoid them is by continuing talking myself. If you're going to talk about cutting expenditures, I want to ask you specifically which programs would you cut? Would you cut veterans' benefits? Would you cut the size of the preparedness program? Would you cut payments on obligations? Where would you make your savings?
I would audit every single expenditure submitted by the president. Nothing is sacrosanct except those items which are set by contract and which are inflexible.
Well, all the things...
I wouldn't consider even the military expenditures beyond audit.
Well, it's perfectly obvious that you're only stating generalities, and furthermore, all the things that you've proposed have been done. Every expenditure of government is audited.
One of the criticisms
that I've heard is that too many people are engaged in the work of auditing government expenditures. Furthermore, Furthermore, the only kind of expenditures that can be made must be subject to congressional approval. Nobody but the Congress can authorize a dollar of expenditure. So I get back to the question, what expenditures would you cut?
My optimistic forecast for 1949 is based on the assumption that the Congress, as you suggested, will audit the executive and that the Jeffersonian Democrats, headed by Senator Byrd of Virginia and George of Georgia, joining with the Republicans of the North, will put some common sense into the entire legislative program, including the budget. And that's what I base my optimism on 1949 for.
Gentlemen, let's get off the budget for a moment. Mr. Keiserling, would reimposition of an excess profits tax in 49, let's get back to the excess profits tax, would that have a deterrent effect on the total volume of sales and of business profits, Mr. Keiserling?
I believe that in a period of high prosperity, taxes should be high enough to balance the budget and to provide substantial retirement on the national debt. I think that the reduction of taxation last year by more than $6 billion was a travesty upon the intelligence of the American people because it could not be made to stick. And in saying that, I'm talking the simplest and most prudent kind of conservative government finance. Balancing the budget by making your revenues equal your expenditures in a period of prosperity and making retirements on your national debt. Now, we can't balance the budget and we can't make substantial retirements on the national debt at the present tax level, and therefore, in this period of high prosperity, taxes should be raised, and incidentally, that will draw money out of the economy and be anti-inflationary.
Drew Kaiser.
I'd like to join that question with one that Mr. Keisling asked a moment or two ago, which I didn't have time to get to. He asked me how business could correct the boom or end the boom. I want to know what he wants to do. Does he want to continue and perpetuate the boom, or does he want to end it? Because with a budget of $45 billion or more, you need a boom in order to balance the budget. You can't have a deflation in the economy and an inflated budget. Which way does he want to go? And if he wants to collect it through taxes, he hasn't answered your question as to whether an excess profits tax would be a deterrent to business volume. I think it would be a great deterrent. It's the most vicious form of taxation because it takes away the incentives for expansion and growth, which are the only hope of offsetting the deflation by diluting it by producing more goods and services.
Well, I said at the beginning that we wanted to avoid both a boom and a deflation. A middle course between a boom and a deflation is easy to define, although it's hard to achieve. The definition, basically, is not to allow fundamental prices to reach the point where buying power can't take the goods off the market. When prices reach that point, basically, you have a falling off in buying, cutbacks in employment and production, and the translation of the boom into a bust. Therefore, the central problem in controlling the boom so as not to avoid the bust doesn't rest with government. It rests with those who make conscious price decisions. And I think if we had somewhat lower prices in relation to the wage and income structure, we'd have a much better chance of controlling the boom and avoiding the bust.
Mr. Rukeyser.
I'm saying that these fellows better make up their minds what they want. If they think profits are too high, if they think we're having too much boom, then they can't expect to get increased taxes on a reduced dollar turnover. They've got to decide whether they want to run in the direction of inflation or deflation. When Mr. Keisling speaks of an intermediate course, he can't finance $45 billion of government expenditures on an intermediate course and balance the budget. It isn't in the cards. And if they want to deliberately reduce profits either by taxation or by other devices or lowering prices, then government, as a participant in business profits through the corporate income tax and the excess profits tax, will have its income correspondingly reduced. So we've got to make up our minds what we want. I thought they were supposed to be economic planners. What are we planning for?
Mr. Keisling, what are we planning for?
Well, we're working toward continuous prosperity. Now, you don't have to have constantly higher prices and a constantly lower value dollar in order to balance the budget and collect enough taxes. We're now operating at a national income of about $250 billion. It's unpractical, even if it might be desirable, to hope to go back to the pre-war price level. But if we could stabilize prices at approximately the present levels and reduce some of them, let's say so that our national income in dollars would be somewhere around $200 billion. And that national income, without increasing prices, but with the maintenance of full employment and stability, would rise by about 3 or 4%, or about $6 to $8 billion a year. And I say that with a national income of that size and healthy conditions throughout the economy, you can raise plenty of taxes to balance the budget without inflation.
True, Kaiser.
Well, I don't recommend killing the goose that lays the golden egg, and the excess profits tax in peacetime is a step in that direction. The rest of the CIO program for economic planning, including a fourth round of wage increases, the attack on profits, the general attack on the competitive system, are further deterrents to going through this readjustment in an orderly way. And my optimistic forecast is based on the belief that the common sense of the American people will prevail in 1949.
Gentlemen, let us pause now to give our studio audience a chance to ask questions. Now, these questions are selected at random, and they're completely unrehearsed. Now, in just a moment, we will call for the opening question. But first, just 60 seconds for an important message.
Thank you, Mr. Granick. And friends, the thousands of employees of Universal Carloading and Distributing Company, our associates and affiliates, join in wishing you and yours a very happy and prosperous new year. And since good resolutions are customary at this time, we'd like to repeat one we've made and kept for many years. Namely, we of Universal Carloading will seek constantly to maintain and improve our nationwide service to shippers and receivers of less-than-carload fast freight, as well as to great railroads, steamship lines, and trucking companies, without whose cooperation such an essential service would not be possible. So during 1949, whenever you have a less-than-carload traffic problem, we invite you to learn how Universal Carloading can help you from coast to coast and border to border. Yes, for your New Year's resolution, we respectfully suggest, for shipments, commercial, specify Universal. Now, back to our moderator, Mr. Granick.
Now let's take the first question from our audience. Over there on the left, I don't know whether he is to the left, but he's left of the audience.
My question is Dr. Kaiserling. Dr. Kaiserling, how can President Truman justify a... and yet control the price of those products that they make?
Well, I think I can answer that question by referring to the war experience. During the war period, we had a federal budget not of $45 billion, but of something over $100 billion. The government was spending over $100 billion a year solely for the winning of the war. And yet, because we had the rational application of intelligent economic policies, we did prevent prices from rising very much, and we did reasonably stabilize the cost of living. And although more than half of our goods were going to war use, we still succeeded even during the war in raising standards of living more than we had ever raised them before in peacetime. Now, if we could do that in wartime, with more than half of our goods going up in destruction, although it was necessary, of course, certainly we can do it in peacetime, when only about 10% of our goods are going to foreign use, and we can do it with far more moderate measures than we had to use in wartime. They can be selective measures rather than overall measures, but they have to be some measures. We can't just neglect the whole situation and let racing prices and inflation carry us on to destruction.
Mr. Rukeyser.
Well, Mr. Kaiserling gave the clue to the inflation problem about which some of his associates have talked so much. He said that during the war, we had a budget around $100 billion. Well, during the war, we made no attempt to live up to his standard of balancing the budget. During the war, we created dollar payments to workers, farmers, and others for all the goods they produced. And as Mr. Kaiserling said, more than half of it went into the government for war purposes and into destruction. Yet the dollar payments are still circulating around. And it's that those dollar payments that represent the inflation problem, because the money supply trebled since 1939. So we're in the position that these politicians, in financing the war and their social projects in peacetime, created this great monetary expansion, which is inflation, and then, like the A man who murdered his mother and father and then pleaded for clemency in court on the ground that he was an orphan. The politicians now want to know who's responsible for inflation.
I'm responsible for another question over there. Go ahead, sir.
My name is Blaine Lillenquist of the Western States Meatpackers Association. I have a question for Mr. Rukeyser. Would it not now be advisable to relax our export controls as an aid to other countries and gradually cut down on dollar grants of aid?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that on the grants and aid under the Marshall Plan and otherwise, that we should notify the recipient countries that we intend to taper off. Otherwise, they'll become accustomed to this high style of living and will set their budgets on the assumption that these payments will be continuous. As for relaxing export controls, I'm in favor of relaxing them as rapidly as we can, and I'm against introducing new controls in the domestic economy.
Another question over there.
I'm Howard Barker from Atlanta, Georgia. Mr. Kaiser, I'd like to ask, if the Taft-Hartley bill is repealed, will it be a boon to or retard business progress?
Well, it depends what attitude business takes toward the repeal of the act. And, of course, I don't know whether or not the act will be repealed. But I should say that the country went along for a long, long time before the act was passed and had very prosperous business conditions. I don't see why it shouldn't have prosperous business conditions if the act should be repealed.
I think the gentleman asked a very intelligent question, because since the administration is so eager to control inflation, it would seem inconsistent to destroy the Taft-Hartley Act, which gives management better control over the cost sheet, which itself is a device for controlling inflation. Mr. Keisling asked me what some of the things that business can do. One of the things that business can do is to operate the cost sheet more intelligently.
Another question over there, please.
My name is Jack Proctor. I'm from the state of Texas. My question is for Mr. Rukeyser. And the question is, how will business be influenced by the anticipated increase of federal taxes in 1949?
Well, these Southerners are the hope of the country. They not only ask intelligent questions, but they're going to vote right in the 81st Congress. The gentleman asks, what will be the effect of increased taxes on business? Well, if at a time of readjustment, when the risks in business are greater than they've been at any time since the war ended, if you give deterrence to enterprise and to the spirit of venturesomeness, I don't see how that will help business. I think the thing that will help business will be incentives, and we saw that work in 1948 when the 80th Congress reduced personal income taxes in spite of the dire predictions made by the economic planners and the Treasury Department that it would result in a great falling off of revenues. The official statistics of the United States Treasury show that in the very current fiscal quarter, revenues did not go off at anything like the estimated amount, but are almost up to last year's peak before the taxes were cut.
Mr. Keisling?
Well, it's very clear that Mr. Rukeyser, by and large, expresses the economic philosophy of the 80th Congress. And I'm willing to rest on that. The people of the country have had a pretty good demonstration of how that philosophy worked in practice. Price controls were taken off to increase production and lower the price of food. We saw how that worked. I think this really gets down to a question of basic economic philosophy. Now, I would like to point this out, that the greatest national income that we ever had in any year before the war was $86 billion, and that we now have a national income of something like $250 billion, and even when you allow for changes in the price level, we're actually producing more per capita by 50% than we ever did before the war at a very much higher tax level. Net profits after taxes are four or five times as high as they ever were before the war.
I'd like to say that you said one thing just now that I agree with entirely. I do lean much more closely to the philosophy of the 80th Congress than to the collectivism that you preach. And the fact that the a difference of votes of 0.5% in Ohio and a few other close states where the farmers were well paid for showing their gratitude to the incumbents hasn't changed my philosophy, although it may have changed yours.
May we take one more question?
Squeeze
in just one, quickly.
My name is Silver. I'm a Southerner on the other side of Moxford, Mississippi. If our spending, Mr. Kaiserling, if our spending for European aid and military preparation were materially lessened, where would the purchasing power to sustain our economy come from?
Well, I think, frankly, that a level of government expenditure somewhere within the range of the present level is not only consistent with, but conducive to, a healthy economy. We've never had as stable an economy as we've had in the past 7 years, 3.5 years of war and 3.5 years of peace. If you define stability, not in terms of the sentiments of a very small group to whom Mr. Rukeyser refers, but in terms of whether or not men and women throughout the country have jobs and by and large have decent standards of living. By those tests, the policies that have been applied over the past few years have produced good results. And I think that if expenditures for foreign aid and for defense should decrease rapidly, we would then be able to, and should, expand the various welfare services, health and education and social security that the people need and that would be conducive to their prosperity.
I know there are many more questions, but we just have time for brief summaries. First, Mr. Rukeyser.
Well, we've heard an interesting exposition by my friend Mr. Kaiserling of the merits of state socialism as opposed to the American competitive system. He charges me with being devoted to the American competitive system, and I plead guilty. I'm for it. It's that under which we've raised our living standards to the highest in the world. And we haven't done it by monetary tricks and calling numbers and labeled dollars, calling these inflated dollars the same as past dollars. Now, to the extent that we've moved towards state socialism, let me give you two simple figures. At the end of the decade of the 20s, government in the United States, national, state, and local, was spending one-sixth of the national income. At the present time, government in the United States, national, state, and local, spending about one-third of the national income.
Thank you, Mr. Rukeyser. Now, Mr. Kaiserling, your summary, please.
Well, I think our real difficulty tonight has been that I've tried to talk about the problems of the present and the future, and Mr. Rukeyser has tried to make a campaign speech for Alf Landon or William Henry Harrison. But that being as it may, I still say that the ultimate decision as to how much money the government spends and what it spends it for rests with the people of the United States. I'm perfectly content to rest on that decision. And if the people of the United States think that Social Security or the protection of the farmer against devastating depressions or aid to education or health or welfare our state socialism, then it's up to them to decide whether or not they want state socialism. I think it's not state socialism. I think it's good Americanism. And I think the people of the country incline toward that viewpoint.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kaiserling and Mr. Rukeyser. I know our radio audience joins me in thanking you for being with us tonight and helping us to better understand this important issue.
You have just heard the American Forum of the Air with Theodore Granick, its founder and moderator, presented in the public interest by Universal Carloading and Distributing Company, America's leading nationwide forwarder of less-than-carload freight. Be sure to be with us again next week, same time, same station, for another exciting discussion. The topic will be, What's Ahead for Congress? Speakers will be Senator Robert Taft and Senator Howard McGrath. This program will originate from Washington. Until then, this is Bernard Dudley reminding you, when you ship commercial, specify Universal. The American Forum of the Air was produced by Larry Dorn. For reprints of tonight's discussion, send 10 cents to Ransdell Incorporated, Washington, D.C. That's 10 cents to RANSDELL Incorporated, Washington 18, D.C. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.